Now, when you've actually picked up the John W. Campbell Memorial Awards, the Hugo Award, just awards galore, basically, clearly you are a writer who basically deserves listening to. When you've also produced a magnus opus, which literally has the three titles, WWW, Wake, Wonder, Watch, all sorts of things, then you might think, well, that's enough. But no, literally, another awesome Robert J. Sawyer text has actually hit the wonderful shelves. It's the Oppenheimer Alternative. It's a wonderful alternative history scenario. I've actually got my own copy delivered, downloaded through the system. It is fantastic. And we're delighted beyond words to actually welcome Robert J. Sawyer back to the program. How are you, Robert?
I'm well, Alex. Thanks, Sue. You know, we're all surviving this COVID-19 madness one way or another. Those of us who are lucky enough to actually survive at all. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. The book is out. It's doing well. And my mood is good. How are you?
Well, exactly. I mean, always good. Delighted to speak to you, good self. Now, alternate history, it's something that clearly Robert Harris, Philip K. Dick, it's got a long and historical route in science fiction. But you've worked a lovely bit of magic with the Oppenheimer Alternative, because you've taken obviously a lot of real life people who existed. And I love the sort of launch of the book, where literally there are only two people who are actually in the cast of characters who are actually still alive and still with us and haven't transcended. But you actually take that line about Alan Oppenheimer, you base it very much in historical fact and the way that things have actually developed. And then, of course, you give it this lovely twist of saying, well, actually, you want to go from from the notion of fission splitting apart to, of course, that wonderful holy grail that's been cited by many sort of physicists as being fusion, atomic fusion, and working through that. Share with us why you came up with the alternative. Was it a case of you looked a few years ago and said, in a few years' time, it'll be 75 years since, of course, the anniversary of the dropping of a bomb in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, etc. Something needs to be written.
Well, first, you're absolutely right. My novel says in the introduction that two of the main characters are still alive. That was true when the typesetting was done. Sadly, we've lost Dr. Freeman. Well, he wasn't a doctor. I shouldn't give him that. Freeman Dyson, who very famously did not have a PhD, but was one of the top theoretical physicists of the 20th century.
And he did have a Dyson sphere, of course, to his
The Dyson sphere he was known for. He was instrumental in so many areas of science, including Project Orion, the atomic rocket design from the late 1950s and 1960s. So one of my... You can't take any joy in the passing of a great man, but I was joyous that I was able to send him a copy of the advanced reading copy, bound galley, of the Oppenheimer Alternative before he passed away. He got it 2 weeks before he passed away. And I got a very nice note from his son, George, who was a very fine, well-regarded science writer / science journalist. So it's sad that now we're down to one, which is Robert Oppenheimer's son, Peter, the only... surviving character.
Yeah. And certainly looking to that, I mean, Project Orion, it's something which I think people have heard about, and the sort of notion that you could actually have by now. And I think those of us who are of a certain age, Robert, will possibly sort of acknowledge the fact that we thought by the time 2020 ticked round, we'd certainly have regular bases on the moon, and probably Martian exploration will be taking place as well. And this theoretical aspect that you would actually have had humanity on Mars by 1965, nuclear power that was put through, it really kind of shows you how, in many ways, yeah, we've taken a different direction in terms of humanity. I mean, whether it hits the three W's that you've come up with before in terms of, I mean, I like to see it as, when you talk about artificial intelligence, are we talking about assimilation or annihilation? It's one of those two sort of segments that we're looking for in terms of how we see that. That's basically just for any artificial intelligence that are downloading this particular piece, this interview from the cloud at present. But returning back to the Oppenheimer Alternative, as a fantastic science fiction writer, was it a case of you wanted to ground it very much in that hard science and then ask that wonderful question, what would have happened if?
Yeah, I am principally a hard science fiction writer. And I think that it is the hard, that means rigorous, it doesn't mean difficult, it means rigorous, science in my science fiction, does give a moral authority, if you will, to talk about issues. If you can easily dismiss the fictional substrate, of a novel, then you don't have to take seriously what the author has to say. Obviously, in the case of Oppenheimer, alternative about arms control, arms reduction, but also about similar crises we face now, which are obviously worldwide climate change and the COVID-19 crisis. Just like in Oppenheimer's day, where the issue was, do we listen to the scientists or do we listen to the politicians? We say we're facing the same thing really for a quarter of a century now, this debate about who should we listen to about climate change. And very recently, particularly in the United States, you're lucky to be where you are. I'm lucky to be in Canada. Neither of us
have to be. Stay north of the border, Robert. Stay north of the border. Right. That's my advice.
Neither of us have to be under the jurisdiction of Donald Trump. But the reality that there's a denier, not just of climate change, which is an existential threat, but not one today. COVID-19 is an existential threat today, and we have a science denier, in theory, the leader of the free world. I think maybe Angela Merkel is the leader of the free world right now, but don't tell Donald. But the question that was at the heart of the Oppenheimer alternative and personified by two of the main characters, J. Robert Oppenheimer, the scientific director of the Manhattan Project, and Leo Szilard, who wrote the letter that was signed by Albert Einstein had sent to President Franklin Roosevelt that started the Manhattan Project, they had very divergent views of the role of the scientist in the public sphere. Oppie said, literally sounding like propaganda, the best and the brightest men in the nation are in Washington making the decisions, and it's not our role to second guess them. And Szilard said, Hungarian with an accent, are you crazy? Are you crazy? We're the brightest people on the planet. Of course we should make the decisions.
It's a really interesting aspect that's there, because it goes all the way back to the notion of H.G. Wells in many ways, who argued in many places that actually a kind of philosopher ruled governments, which actually had scientists at the top of the list, were there. And then, of course, there was the suggestion that had been put to him that with the advent and the rise of fascism and so on, it actually completely devastated his take on that whole sort of system, because, of course, it had been misused, misappropriated, mishandled, distorted in many ways from the point of view of, well, where do we actually go to find some kind of sense of sensible leadership?
Well, this is a huge question. Now, one of, you know, there are all kinds of little joys you discover when you're doing research for any topic. One of the great joys for me was when I started digging into Leo Szilard, is to find out not only did he know H.G. Wells, but he was H.G. Wells's literary agent for translated editions in Europe for a time. And Wells's The World Set Free, not the one that we think of today as one of the major works of Wells. We think of Time Machine, War of the Worlds, Invisible Man. But The World Set Free, which is the novel in which Wells proposed the notion of an atomic bomb. Of course, he didn't have the physics right. I mean, if he had the physics right, we would have had atomic bombs in World War I instead of World War II. But he had the notion that the atom somehow embodied within it enormous amounts of energy that, if released, could be devastating on the world stage. And Szilard not only was inspired by that, but also by Wells's notion of a worldwide government, of a government, a leadership of intellectuals. And Szilard had his own version. He called it the Bund, the German word, B-U-N-D, Bund, where the world would be run by the best and the brightest minds, not the biggest political climbers. There is a naivety in that, because the best and brightest minds seem to always forget that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we've seen time and time again idealistic reforms in how we govern our societies always twisting and turning ultimately to be number one for the preservation of those who were responsible for the revolution. They don't want a revolution and then step back and let it organically develop. They want a resolution that sees them become emperor for life. And Szilard and Oppenheimer, these scientists do tend to be naive about what we call real politic, about the way politics actually works, about the corruptibility of the human animal.
There's a wonderful quote that you actually introduced chapter two with, actually from Leo Szilard. Question: what is an optimist? Answer: one who thinks the future is uncertain. I did like that. I thought it sort of set the scene quite nicely. I mean, yes, we have to obviously be constantly vigilant. We have to monitor the system. But yes, the misuse of power, as you said, the classic aphorism, absolute power corrupts absolutely, is very much to the fore of that. So let's focus down in terms of the Oppenheimer alternative. We've seen some of the ways in which things have developed within that. Science fiction writes, as we said with H.G. Wells, as partly emerging from the cultural milieu out of which it was written. I think Stephen Baxter, who in many ways would actually say is the kind of natural successor to Wells, and obviously it looks at the Wells estate and has written sequels to The Time Machine and the War of the Worlds, of course, I think would acknowledge that balance of hard science is important. As here we sit, as I say, in 2020, living in a science fiction world, an alternate reality possibly from that point of view, do you think we can actually take some lessons from that particular era of Oppenheimer and Einstein and Szilard and the people on the Manhattan Project? Or is it a case of, I mean, that immortal phrase, I have become death, the destroyer of worlds, that kind of comes together, and that the fear factor comes into play? People are actually afraid of the science.
So absolutely, we have, astonishingly, given that everything we do, including right now, free video chatting across the Atlantic Ocean, oh my God, that's science fiction, right?
Communication. I thought I just waved a wand.
As Arthur C. Clarke would say, any sufficiently advanced technology, is indistinguishable from magic. We live in a world where everything around us is driven by science and technology that the average person understands hardly at all. So the lesson, you know, when Oppenheimer had that notion, he didn't actually say it out loud until years later. Probably the first time he said it was in a television interview, but he claims he thought in 1945, July 16th, 75 years ago, at the Trinity test, recalling the Bhagavad Gita, Oppy was a great expert on Hindu scripture. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. And the idea that this first occurred to him, the consequences of what he was doing when the atomic bomb was actually set off for the first time, is so apropos of our world situation today. You mentioned that I wrote three novels about the World Wide Web gaining consciousness, Wake, Watch, and Wonder. Most work in artificial intelligence is done by people who are giving no thought at all to the economic impact that it will have, the devastation of our normal employment base, to the possibility, as you mentioned, of the two incredibly negative but equally likely scenarios that we will be subjugated or that we will be absorbed by our own creation, our successors. No species in history has ever done that. The mammals weren't taking over from the dinosaurs because the dinosaurs said, you know what, we had a good run, but it's somebody else's turn now, right?
And Robert, obviously you also destroyed one of my own favorites. I'm holding up one of his texts here, the Isaac Asimov whole complete robot series, in which actually you do raise that question. You raise it in the forehand that Asimov's three laws of robotics are little more than actually legalized slavery for sentient form.
And Asimov, if you had asked Isaac Asimov, and I had the great privilege of meeting him and interviewing him for CBC Radio here in Canada, if you had asked him, are you in favor of the subjugation of certain kinds of human beings? You'd have said no. Are you in favor of slavery? No. Are you in pro-freedom? Sure. Yes. He was, you know, there was a spectrum of science fiction writers with Asimov and Clark well to the left of center, and maybe Heinlein moving from a centrist to farther to the right as time went on. But without thinking through the consequences, and they're really only there in the very late robot stories, does he give any thought to the rights of robots. He said a robot should be like, and Battlestar Galactica, adopted this terminology. They referred to the Cylon robots in the new Battlestar as toasters, right? That goes right back to Asimov. He said a robot should be like any other household appliance, a toaster. A toaster should not be able to injure you. It should be engineered to sufficient specifications that you're not going to get burned, that you're not going to cut yourself on a sharp edge. A toaster should not be able to do anything but make toast. You don't want it coming and interfering with the rest of your life. It has to obey the orders, right? And a toaster is valuable. It better last, not just for the warranty period, but for the rest of your life. It has to protect its own existence. That toaster metaphor for AI, with no regard to the servility that we were going to subject AI to one, even once it became conscious. It's Asimov failing to think through the consequences, Oppenheimer failing to think through the consequences, our researchers today in AI or cutting-edge weapons research, or Kalashnikov creating weapons designed for military use. Even he never would have thought that the AK-47 would become most famous for being used in civilians shooting other civilians in mass shootings by unhinged individuals. The failure to think ahead is the failure of science and the value of science fiction.
Absolutely. And looking towards, I mean, I cited obviously the Measure of a Man episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which Data is referred to as a toaster. Going back to Arthur C. Clarke, I think he actually alluded to the notion that fire, the discovery of fire, brings great advantages, great support and so on, but clearly there are issues relating to that as well in terms of obviously the double-edged sword. And I think the way that you actually define, even in his personal relationships for Oppenheimer, in terms of how he relates to the two main women in his life and how in a sense they relate to him as well, I think is really nicely put together, because it shows again somebody who's clearly very focused. But again, whether it's because of perceived anti-Semitism that comes across in one side because of the father and the medieval scholar who's actually there, whether it's a case of the other sort of line things. I mean, I think that the wonderful early line that's in the text about basically God never getting never wanting to be laid, etc. That was a wonderful sort of one line that was around from that point of view. But I think that's what really impressed me, Robert, about this particular book, that it does get that balance. It doesn't take out the humanity. So people who are looking for a text which, oh, the thing about science, hard science fiction, it sounds too full of shiny robots and so on. This isn't. You've very much managed to tap into the human side as well.
Well, thank you so much. You know, the genre is called science fiction. The words are the same length. They're seven letters long. And I've always felt that the goal of a science fiction writer should be to give equal weight to the two sides. Not all my colleagues agree. And some have had far greater success than I have by disagreeing. Larry Niven is a classic example of a guy who loves
but
the science
war.
Part.
He's into war.
Well, and Larry and I are divergent politically. We're great friends. We're great friends. And that's the beauty of our subculture of science fiction until at least the last year or two, where even the polarization of the rest of the world has come to it. But it used to be where Arthur C. Clarke and, a Larry Niven or a Jerry Purnell could be friends instead of being enemies, despite being on completely opposite sides of the political spectrum. But this thinking through of the politics of all of it is so important. And scientists like Oppenheimer, who wanted to divorce themselves from any moral responsibility, I think have given us a great deal of trouble in the world, ultimately.
Absolutely. Robert, just a slight diversion, as ones want to do. I must admit, I was amazed to find that you're responsible for one of my favourite TV series and short-lived TV series, which I thought was really sad it didn't actually expand, Flash Forward, because you were involved with respect to that. Because, again, that dealt very much with the time elements and obviously alternate dimensions and so on. Is there a particular area, whether it be the hard science fiction, I mean, genetic engineering, that's another sort of major line which is often sort of posited as a fearsome one, or is it just a case of you're inspired by what seems to be, in a sense, historically aspects that have related to us as human beings and how we relate to the technology?
You know, it's interesting because here I am 24 books in, and it's for others to assess my oeuvre, to decide what it is that I've accomplished. And there was a review that just came out of the Oppenheimer Alternative, and it said the thing that links Robert J. Sawyer's work is a fascination with what's morally right and what's morally wrong. And I hadn't considered that. If you'd asked me 2 weeks ago before I'd read that review, what was the thing? I said, well, I've got a fascination with the nature of consciousness, of the inner life versus the outer life, which is somewhat related to right and wrong, but not completely. And I came to realize, no, that's exactly right. That is the thing. And I'm an atheist. I'm completely devoid of any belief that morality is imposed upon the human species by either a standard, a heavenly standard, or by the fear of retribution, of divine retribution or punishment. I believe it is something innate to the human animal, different from almost all, but not all, other animals, that we have an innate sense of right and wrong, and that there has to be a scientific understanding and a rational understanding, an intellectual understanding. And I think that in terms of the Oppenheimer Alternative, what did he do? Did he do the right thing and stop in creating the bomb? There are those who argue to this day that, yes, he saved not just American lives, but Japanese lives too by shortening the war. There are others who argue, no. They could have ended the war a year earlier. They only continued for the soulless scientific experiment of testing what the actual effects of their two very different bomb designs, Fat Man and Little Boy, would have on actual cities. And they had to prolong the war. They gave up the fiction that the purpose of the Manhattan Project was to defeat Hitler, which is, you mentioned anti-Semitism, which is how they recruited so many leading Jewish intellectuals, so many of the people involved, Einstein, Szilard, many, many of the others, Oppenheimer himself, I.I. Rabi, were Jewish, and they had a stake, a cultural stake, in the genocide that was going on in Europe, and being told, here, you've got a chance to use your brain to defeat Adolf Hitler and stop the pogrom, to stop the Holocaust. Oh my God, of course they sign up. And then when Hitler kills himself, why did they stay on? Why did the project continue? Because General Groves said at the Trinity test, we're continuing until we've done two atomic bombs on Japan. I have to come clean. That's the real reason to test the implosion and the uranium gun designs in battle. That's what we're here for. Nobody leaves until we're done.
I'm reminded of something I often say to my own students, basically the old line, when somebody actually says, trust me, it's the last thing you should do. Just step away from that. Just work your own sort of intellectual processes around the whole system. Robert, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. The Oppenheimer Alternative is, of course, available online. All good booksellers and various other aspects as well. There is something magic in a sense about reading the thing online on a device from that point of view, which again, 30, 40 years ago, we said inconceivable. I still have a fondness, obviously, for the sort of solidity sure. of text, etc., but it's still worth considering.
It's changed the way I've written. I'll mention also it's on audiobook too, but my preference as a reader is to read ebooks these days. Why? Because I can click on any word and get the definition. So as an author, I don't have to slow down the text. If I use a word from nuclear physics that you absolutely have to understand, of course I explain it in the text. But if it's just there for flavor or background, but you're a curious reader, nobody wants you to have to set down your book and go and haul a paper dictionary off the shelf. No author ever wanted that. But I have a more seamless writing style now, and I think many of my colleagues do, because we know that if you're curious, Wikipedia, Google, and really good dictionaries are a click away from your reading experience. We can focus much more on the minutiae of the story we're telling rather than having to make the book completely self-contained the way a paper book has to be.
It would certainly have actually changed the work of Jules Verne, I think, in many ways, arguably one of the first kind of well, romantic science fiction writers, before we paved the way for H.G. Wells and so on. Robert, we could talk for a whole range of things. There's one little line that I came across, which I thought, I'm not sure about this. Robert J. Sawyer has been described as Canada's answer to Michael Crichton. You're much better than Michael Crichton. He just did Jurassic Park, Coma, and Westworld. You know, you've got a whole plethora of good things that are coming through with respect to that. Two final questions for you, good soul. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Oh, absolutely. This is astonishing. You know, another great, well, I shouldn't say great when I say another Canadian science fiction writer, a great one, William Gibson, said famously decades ago, the future is already here. It's just not widely distributed. Well, the world has realized here in 2020, thanks to COVID, that the future is here, that teleconferencing is here, that remote work is here, that all of these technologies exist and are mature. We're not inventing them out of necessity here in 2020. Oh, you mean I could have been doing this in 2015 and 2010 as well? How come no? I didn't get the memo. Nobody told me. So we are living in a science fiction age where finally everybody is embracing the science fiction reality of the second decade, or the third we're into now, of the third millennium.
Absolutely, and certainly in terms of William Gibson's Neuromancer, there's a whole new area we could actually go down there, cyberpunk technologies, all manner of other bits and pieces. Just goes to show, at the end of the day, we need visionaries like yourself, Robert, to keep us going, and perhaps most importantly, keep us aware of the kind of moral and ethical questions that probably need to be asked as well. So the final question for your good self today is, will you be kind enough to return and join us once more in this sort of Zoom-based mechanism, which then goes into radio, which then goes into podcasts, and so on and so forth?
Alex, it would be my absolute pleasure and privilege, 100%.
A namer, an improviser, a producer, a writer, a gamer, and a man of the internet cloth. Not my words, but the words of our awesome guest who has basically come sealed with the platinum Phil Leonis seal of approval and recommendation. It's a genuine delight to be able to welcome to the Midweek Drive the awesomely talented Mark Hirshhorn. How are you, Mark?
Oh, great, great. Thank you, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, again, we've just been told by our Prime Minister that rather than actually trying to work from home if we can, we should try to go to work if we can. So, who knows? Again, our little mini Trump, as we like to refer to him, is obviously on the case. So what can we say? We'll just work our way through that.
Well, our major Trump wants our children to go back to school so the leaders of tomorrow could be working in close proximity to each other.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there we are. Anyway, and as I said earlier to Robert J. Sawyer, our award-winning science fiction writer, he's best off staying north of the border in Canada. That's the line to work on that. Mark, the reason we're actually talking today, as well as obviously getting the being on our list of people we need to speak to for years now, basically. So it's a genuine delight. Succotash. Now, I'm of the generation that remembers, obviously, Sylvester, and Daffy Duck. Succotash. I'm not going to try and impersonate that. And I thought, and for years I didn't know what it was. I just thought it was some kind of expression. It was like an American routine. I didn't realize it was a bean-based soup or a collection of beans and so on. And then, of course, it manifested in terms of Succotash Radio, the Succotash Show, part
That's right.
of your own collection. So just talk us through, before we get into Sleeve Talkers, which is a whole new world, talk us through Succotash and how you came up with the concept in the first place.
Sure. You know, I originally started Succotash back in 2011 when podcasting was, it had gotten started and then it sort of started to stumble a bit. And there were a lot of comedians doing podcasts, a lot of comedy podcasts, and nobody knew anything about them. I think maybe 15% of the United States had even heard of what a podcast was, let alone had heard them. And I was wanting to do a comedy podcast, and I just hit on this idea of, well, why don't I promote all these other friends of mine that are doing them? So I needed a name, and I am actually a professional branding person. I name things for a living. And so I said, why don't I get a name that's really hard to pronounce and difficult to spell? That's perfect. But no, the idea was, you know, succotash is this bean-based side dish, and it's very regional in the United States. So there's various types of succotash. It's all very different. People put beans and carrots and peas and all sorts of lima beans, things like that in there. And I said, well, this is kind of a fun way to talk about the fact I play clips of other people's comedy podcasts. That's what the genesis of the show was. So on any given show, you might, at the time, you might've heard 7, 8, 9, 10 different clips. So it just felt like a fun way to talk about it.
It's like a potpourri of quality comedy.
That's it is a potpourri, a name, but, a name that was taken. Well,
darn it, never mind. Let's move on, of course, to a very special episode of Suffering. So I'll drop the suffering. It's not suffering. It's, you see, Hanna-Barbera obviously influenced me heavily as a child, and I just
believe
need to
me,
step away from that.
I have suffered through many putting episodes of Succotash together. So oftentimes it is Suffering Succotash.
Well, there you go. But a recent episode that Phil sent me the link to, and it just triggered off a whole range of things, was a special pilot episode of something which I've already kind of had some really good feedback from people who actually said, I want to listen to that. I need to listen to it now. Because I kind of described it as a show in which you have the president, former President Obama's dog. You have Phil Dennis and Dana Carvey, and of course a chocolate bowl or a dessert holder that goes missing. I mean, what's not to love about that?
You know, exactly. In terms of connection.
So this particular thing, which if people do not actually take it up for a full series, I think they're crazy and insane. But talk us through how you came up with this idea and how obviously you connected with Phil and Lily Holloman and Dana Carvey and some of the other greats obviously appear in the actual set. I mean, Dana, he does Putin, he does Trump. It's the whole thing.
He does. Well, it's funny. The whole idea started actually back at the last year of George W. Bush's administration. And I had gotten together with some other comedy writers at the time, and I wanted to create this this Twitter universe where each of these people was a Secret Service agent. They were all working the overnight shift of the Secret Service at the White House. And we never know what goes on in there anyway. And I figured the people on the overnight shift have to be kind of like maybe the night, not quite brightest lights in the string. And so we started doing these separate tweets, and then it was all being sort of brought together as one collective unit under a thing called the third detail, which is what I called the overnight shift. And then over time, I couldn't get enough sort of traction with that idea. We sort of played with it through the Obama administration a little bit. And then when Trump came back in, we said, we have to do something with this idea. And so Janine Hansen, who was one of the original sort of tweeting agents, and she actually coined the Sleeve Talkers title, which I think is beautiful because, when you see those guys.
Demonstrating it on the screen.
Exactly. So they talk into their sleeves when they're on their walkie-talkies. And I said, how am I going to pull this off? Because it really calls for a big cast of like 8, 9, 10 people. And it just sort of coincidentally turns out to be ideal to produce in a time of COVID. Now, we actually recorded this pilot 2 years ago. And
the ahead way of the I game, Mark. Always ahead of the game. That's what we like about you.
Yeah, and so I said, how am I going to get all, I can't get all these people in one studio. So I said, well, the beauty is they're on walkie-talkies. I mean, and that's the gimmick of the show, is you only hear everybody on their walkie-talkies. And if you hear Trump, it's in conversation with the agent assigned to him, who leaves his channel open so the other agents can hear what's going on. And so I just had everybody basically either use Skype or their cell phones. And I couldn't get everybody timed together, so I recorded them all separately. And then I played the character they were talking to. So I knew the consistency of how I wanted the dialogue to go. And then my brilliant producer, Joe Polino, who's been producing Succotash since I started. He also voices Agent Torque in the pilot. He came up with this great idea, and you being an audio person, I'm sure you've appreciated this, is he created a micro universe for each of those agents where they're broadcasting from. So one guy is in the Rose Garden, and one guy's in the break room, and the main person is in the control center. And behind all of their radio calls, you can hear that atmosphere back there. So it gave this sense of space, you know. And then we just put it together. But nobody was ever in the same room at the same time except me and Joe putting it together. And I think the most exhaustive we were is when you hear the submarine hatch open when Putin shows up in the underground submarine pen. That was Joe and I actually manhandling a metal manhole cover in the street outside his home at 9 o'clock at night to get that perfect submarine hatch sound.
the joys of getting actuality into your production is tremendous. And I must admit, as I say, I thought how true to life Phil's particular character was, because I can understand him being most upset about somebody stealing his pudding bowl. You know, I could understand that. You know, it kind of yes. resonated with me.
Exactly. And I even reached across the pond. Davian Dent voices our exchange agent, Agent Hyde Smythe from MI5. And he's actually a podcaster from London. And he has a couple of shows over there. One's called The Bitter Sound. And he's a bit of a sound engineer and aficionado himself. So we actually got an actual person to do it and not have an American try to do the accent.
It's the special relationship, Mark. The special relationship that's there. One thing that crossed my mind, I don't know if you're familiar with a series called Spitting Image in the States.
Yes.
Which once had a kind of ongoing line in the era of Ronald Reagan, called "The President's Brain is Missing." And that was a line that seemed to work very solidly. And I'm thinking in this one, the sort of subtext is, "The President's toupee is missing." And in yes. a thought, you know, sort of just crossed my mind in terms of the way it actually is. No spoilers, obviously. Go and actually download the actual Succotash show to actually listen to it yourself and enjoy it from a point of view. Are there any plans for a follow-up, another sort of line from this? I mean, I'm thinking you had George Bush, technically you had President Shrub, Little Bush. Then you actually have the next stage, obviously, with, I don't know how we describe our current income, or your current sort of incumbent, but he's there anyway. I mean, if Kanye West gets it, shall we say, in November.
My goodness.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I plan to do a first season of 10 episodes and actually have them outlined. And we've been in negotiations with a couple of different companies. And then they just kind of fell apart, as these things do. My producer wants to go back and do a retrospective of 8 episodes of just the Trump administration. And use basically our same cast of characters, but he's been doing a thing called TrumpPoetry.com. And literally since the first day of Trump getting in office, he's written like a short poem. And so he's got the chronology of everything that's happened in poetry form, and that would be the basis for this other Sleeve Talkers series. So I think obviously there's a very rich bit of content there. The secret is finding somebody who believes in it enough to say, yeah, okay, you know, we see how much it's going to cost you to do these episodes, and here's a little bit of money to do it. So that's really the only thing holding us back at this point.
I'm thinking actually Homer's Iliad, you know, thousands of years ago, actually, you know, creating this whole sort of system in the same way as you've actually got, you know, a poet actually doing a day-by-day analysis of Trump. I bet he'd hoped actually it would all be over within 100 days. Oh, no, it's still there.
I think we were all wishing that, but...
Well... Obviously, I couldn't possibly comment because let's face it, we're on Zoom. CIA are listening. Who knows? That's the key thing. You know, hi. Interestingly enough, I'm still working on persuading Phil to go to Zoom because, again, he has this nervousness. I mean, I think you are now our 44th successful Zoom interviewee. And so far, I haven't actually had a knock on the door from the CIA as yet. You don't know. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's a par for the course. Working with Dana Carvey, I'm mostly familiar with his fantastic work with Wayne's World, of course. Mike Myers and Dana Carvey from that point of view. You sold your first script back in 1983. Writing comedy can be a challenge at the best of times because as many of my students actually turn around and say when they initially want to say, oh, we'll do a comedy show. I said, do you realize how hard it actually is to do comedy? Because I think the statistic goes that something like 90% of people kind of believe they can tell a joke. Actually, probably only 2% can in terms of effectiveness and timing and so on. So actually to write that and come up with something innovative and current and contemporary. So how do you do it, Mark? How do you actually produce these kind of things? Your chance to actually share a comedy masterclass from yourself.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, as Dana Carvey says, well, this is a script we've written, but this is just going to stay in this desk drawer and nobody is going to see this. You have to be, I always say, and I've been, you know, a student of and performer of improvisational comedy for like 30 years at this point. Everything has to get out on the table. It's the only way you're going to get to see whether anything really is funny. But in the end, that's where you have to kind of exercise your judgment and say, all right, so we're going to send this out or we're going to perform this and we'll see what happens. And, you know, if it isn't flying, let's either figure it out or let's just quietly put it away. And so, yeah, I've got a hard drive full of things that are quietly put away. On the other hand, working with Dana is, it really is a kind of magic. He is an incredibly gifted performer, an incredibly gifted comic mind. And I've known him since 1983 when I sold my first script. Like for Sleep Talkers, he was happy to do it because it took him literally 6 minutes to do the parts that you hear in the show. And it was funny because after he finished, he goes, "That's it? That's all you needed me for?" He says, "George Clooney would do this work." I said, "Well, do you have his number? Because I would love to have him." But I think the secret is really being willing to explore everything and at the same time being your harshest critic. At the same time, when it comes time to actually put it out there in front of people. And you have to listen. You have to listen to critics. You have to listen to people. I know a lot of people that don't, they refuse to read their reviews. There are comedians that refuse to tape their own acts and listen to them back. And those are the ones that I don't know that they do as well as the people that are willing to be self-critical. It's a very difficult gene to play with, is that self-criticism.
There's a line that springs to mind that I've often regarded as quite a significant one, which is life is a comedy to those who think, a tragedy to those who feel. And yes. I think, you know, it's often that whole sort of system springs to mind. And it's probably one of the reasons.
I also like the line, I think it's Olivier who said, when somebody was saying, was complimenting him on his drama, and he said, dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm often sort of struck by folk when they're doing a dramatic performance. And it used to surprise me a few years ago because they said, "Oh, we had such a great time. Everybody was," I said, "You're doing a serious drama here." And actually it was easier from that point of view than actually getting into comedic mode, etc. But there we are. That's everything for Pagliacci. He had it right, didn't he? And that sort of thing, you know, the whole sort of sequence. The agony of the whole thing.
Yeah, he did indeed.
So what else are you kind of involved with, and how can people actually access Succotash if they're listening to this wherever in the globe that they might be?
Of course. The beauty of doing a podcast or internet radio is that we have a medium that literally is available internationally to people, which is amazing. Succotash is at succotashshow.com, but it's also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. I always like to say wherever fine podcasts are streamed and or downloaded.
You should join us on Podbean for SouthsideBroadcasting.com on Podbean, which is all there, you know. We've always liked Podbean ever since 2009, you know. It's a different line, really.
I've covered a number of shows that come out through Podbean. In fact, I think we've covered Afternoon Drive on Succotash probably several years ago. But we'll do it again. You know, it's funny. I review comedy podcasts for Vulture.com, which is the New York Magazine's online presence. And I use it as my secret sort of research to figure out what we're going to feature on Succotash by going through all these other things I have to listen to. But you asked what I have coming up. And funny enough, you mentioned Dana, and he and I wrote a pair of companion scripts back around 2008, 2009, and they've been living in his desk drawer for a decade, because he sent them to one producer. He never heard back and figured, well, we're not going to do anything with these. And then just literally 2 days ago, I was talking to him on the phone, and he said, you know, I've been hearing people have been doing online screenplays. They've been doing audio versions of screenplays. Do you think we could do that with ours? Because we actually committed one entire screenplay to an audio production. And he did a bunch of the voices. I did some of the voices. We have music. It's fully kind of prepared. And I said, yeah, try and stop me from that. We'd love to get that out. But they're hilarious scripts. And he just keeps telling me every time we chat, he goes, you know, I pulled this one out again. It just keeps making me laugh. I go, well, let's do something with it. So we're hoping those things will finally see the light of day, which would be wonderful.
You know, 100 years or so ago, people were actually just experiencing the medium of radio. They were doing all sorts of entertaining things and putting things. We've kind of come full circle, really, haven't we? Except, you know, we're still using the audio package. People said, oh, the cinema's going to, the movies will take radio out of the system. TV yeah. will take it out of the system. We're still here. That's the important thing.
Well, and Alex, you may be the same. My initial sort of indoctrination was when I was in junior high school, which was like grades 7 and 8. I used to listen to a radio station here in San Francisco, and they would play old radio shows. between like 10 and 11 at night. I had like a pillow speaker so I could listen at night when my parents wouldn't see I was still awake. And I cut my teeth on listening to Jack Benny and Fred Allen and X-1 and all these amazing audio shows. And then I got into radio years later. And now here we are again, back in essentially radio, which is exactly. Amazing.
And you mentioned one of my favorites, though, of course, X-1, 1,000 could be worlds and 1,000,000 maybe planets and
yes,
so on.
Yes.
X-1.
In a world of reboots, why hasn't somebody done something like
that? I know. Exactly. Yeah. X-1. The campaign starts here, Mark. This is where we begin. This transatlantic campaign to bring back X-1.
I love it. Yes.
Mark, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. I mean, generally shooting the breeze. Can't believe we haven't done it before. Thanks to Phil for setting the whole thing through. That was marvellous. Two final critical questions, slight variations, obviously. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I have had a tremendous Zoomer with you.
Therefore, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future? Will you come back and join us once more?
Only if you'll agree to come on Succotash as my guest.
I would be honoured. Every sense. Just name the date, name the time, and we will be there.
That sounds great, Alex. Thank you so much.
300, Terminator Salvation, Epic, Rio, Lost, 24, Sleepy Hollow, Sons of Anarchy, Showrunners, Blacklist, The Art of Big Trouble in Little China, so much more, Outlander, and forthcoming, of course, Marvel Studios, the first 10 years, the definitive story behind the Blockbuster Studio, one of the key content creators behind that and co-authors and general all-round wonderful folk is the legendary Tara Bennett. Tara, it is good to connect with you after far too long of gap.
Alex, it's such a pleasure. I'm so glad to hear that you're doing well and that you're still doing this. You know, any little bit of normalcy with the world and caving in is a wonderful thing.
Well, as I say, we haven't quite got to the stage of effectively sort of being able to connect via video because obviously the magic isn't there. So I won't give you the shock of seeing, of looking at me from that point of view, but you know, life continues. I thought you might have an otter to hand, Tara.
I wish. I feel like I would like to just go to a sanctuary and just go live with the otters. My days would be really stress-free and wonderful, but unfortunately I haven't figured out how to make that work financially yet. So I still write. That is what I do.
And write very well, it has to be said. We have missed you, Tara. And certainly when I was doing a feature with the former editor, it's like former president of the United States, actually, former editor of SFX magazine, Richard Edwards, really. He was sort of saying we should really get together, and I think before too long we will, the three of us, get a magical thing happening. But anyway, let's move on, because literally in terms of time we are about 1 week and 4 days, I think, more or less, away from the first San Diego Comic Con at home, the online experience. Will you be part of that?
I'm certainly going to be covering it for SFX and for Sci-Fi Wire. And it's weird. This technically is my 18th straight year of doing San Diego Comic-Con, but doing it from home is going to be really, really weird. I'll admit it. It's going to, you know, I guess we've all in this business been transitioning into a world where we just look at our tablets or look at our laptop screens with lots of other little screens in it now in the Zoom world. And I guess, you know, I feel like we've been transitioning towards that all year. I cover things for press, which is really just kind of shifted over to that. And then obviously in California with the Emmy nominations, which are out this month, we've had all of these collections of people doing TV shows getting together on Zoom. And so I guess San Diego is the greatest, like, kind of, here's where we are with technology and making it look as good as possible. But yeah, everything is no badge. Everybody can go this year. You know, they're still doing exclusives. You just have to do it online and buy it online. And you know, we just lose the ability to be in the room together. So I guess we'll see how it feels. How are you feeling about it?
Well, I think overall, I am slowly but surely getting used to it. And it's going to be an interesting thing when our, as I like to refer to him, mini Trump, who's in 10 Downing Street, is saying, oh, it's time we actually got back to going to work after staying at home and so on. In many ways, actually, you reduce the carbon footprint, you reduce various other factors. What we're doing now, actually doing a good quality recording across the Atlantic Ocean at a time which is convenient, which doesn't sort of hinge on the live Wednesday slots, etc. Lots of changes. But then as Robert J. Sawyer, the science fiction writer and award-winning writer who was responsible, I think, for Flash Forward, amongst other things, but he was saying at the start of this piece, this you're the cherry on the top of this cake, Tara, basically, as inevitably you're going to be. You know, Robert J. Sawyer, and then on to Saturday Night Live and Succotash podcast host Mark Hershon, and then yourself, Tara. But Robert's line was, we are, like it or not, living in a science fiction world. We're in the third decade of the 21st century. This is it. This is what we've been waiting for.
And I honestly feel much better than, as you said, we both have administrations that are not quite thinking about our cumulative health and certainly putting us in rooms together. We're having the debate about going back to school right now. And I wouldn't want to be a Comic-Con. Comic-Con in the best of times is still 150,000 plus people. And if you're in one of the big rooms, 3,000 to 7,000 people crammed together watching something. And the exhilaration of that is great. But most people left that event having some kind of cold, regardless, because it's just too many germs from too many parts of the world. And so with a pandemic actually happening, I couldn't enjoy myself, you know? So at least there's a taste. And as we're trying to find some normalcy, that they've really done a lot of effort, the schedules are out now. And there's some really great schedules, the things that you would go and see. So it's really nice that they've kept up the level of participation and those that are going to be part of it. And again, I don't think it's a bad thing that a lot of people need it right now, that there's no badges, so everybody can participate in it, get a taste of it, and I think that's really good.
Yeah, so again, thumbs up for that. And also I think thumbs up to August, where DC and the DC universe are actually having a whole DC World extravaganza. So
So it kind of parcels it out. We lose Star Wars Celebration, but we get DC, and they certainly are all in with all of their talent for that. So it feels like, yeah, you know, thanks for at least I'm appreciative that, yes, they have things to sell. They're selling the soap, but at the same time, it's kind of breaking up the monotony. I know all of us don't even know what day it is practically anymore. So it's nice to at least have some things that we have to look forward to. You know, those are good. That's a good thing.
Exactly. So you see, let's accentuate the positive, as we said in so many ways. Now, I'm going to run a little tease for you now, Tara, because I've got a back issue of SFX magazine upon my person here. And I'm going to give you a little quote from an article that you've actually written. And I wonder if you can actually identify the show that it's actually referring to. I know it's a tough call, but
good.
I think
I'm ready.
You'll be able to work it. Okay. What the actual balance of that will look like, Cannon says, is still very much a work in progress. There has been slight pressure, but not much, as Warner Brothers and Fox have been fantastic, allowing us to push the boundaries a little bit and make a more adult-themed show, but we haven't found the narrative balance yet. Ooh. Do you have any idea what show you're actually referring to there?
Okay, help me out only with, is it 2019? Or are we going way back with the back
issue? Well, not way back. I mean, time is an illusion, Tara. I mean, at the end of the day, as cosmologists would say, we're existing simultaneously. Oh. We're having this conversation, we're being born, we're going through our lives, we're playing with otters, we're wrapping up the midweek drive. All things happen simultaneously. It's just the illusion of time. 2014. 2014 was the year.
Gotham?
Hey, you see, no messing about that. I mean,
really?
When we tested out a review that Robin Pierce from another magazine, Starburst, sorry, I have to mention it, but he took a lot longer to actually get through there. But we knew you would, Tara, at the end of the day.
You know what? You just tested whether or not I'm completely losing my mind here in quarantine, and I feel really good. I feel like you have just given me enough wind for the next 6 months.
There we are.
Any kind of recall. Thank you very much.
A classic line. It was a preview of obviously upcoming shows. An interesting Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is still going. Obviously Gotham isn't.
I know.
We had thought that the Supernatural show would have kept going, but didn't after a long time, but it kept on lasting. And of course, you were introducing new show, iZombie. Which I thought was a lovely treat, really.
It was a great show. It was fantastic. It's actually all of those things that you mentioned. It's amazing because Supernatural was supposed to be finished last month, but obviously they couldn't finish shooting it. So it technically might go another year because if they can't finish shooting it in Vancouver, we still get the drag out of the very last season of that. And then to those listening, it was just announced that Matt Reeves You know, obviously the director of the new The Batman that's going to be in theaters whenever. But he's going to be doing a spin-off show of his world of Batman, the cinematic Batman that he's doing. And it sounds just like Gotham. So yeah. I think we're in a little bit of a strange time warp in that some things are still here. Some things sound like they're coming back again. It's kind of hilarious.
Exactly. I mean, I must admit, in terms of this particular Ed Zone 2014, there was a wonderful line, which again, in your raves and rants section as U.S. editor. Ooh. Those days, of course, you were just U.S. editor for the East Coast. Now you're you've got the entire country, Tara.
I got the country. I have had a bump up, a glow up, as they say.
And you know, Tara, I will not be content until it's actually Tara Bennett for the world. I mean, this is the key thing. You know, it's all very well having East Coast, West Coast. I think you need the let's move to the continent of North America.
Then my we'll take my slow roll out. I plan that as well. I like it. Exactly. I'll take it.
But I love the line in which you actually have for rants, which presumably you would never have used with the actual creators at the time. Rants, do we really need another Batman origin story via Gotham? I'm feeling origined out when it comes to comic book mythology backstories on the big and small screen. See, that shows the diplomacy that the White House could use, you see.
I think so. I hope that Matt takes a really different path, because I am burnt out. I am burnt out of the actual origin story of Batman. I feel like, you know, whenever they can move us along and get us deeper into mythology quicker, I'm a happy woman.
Exactly. There's a place for Teen Titans Go where you just jump into the story straight away.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's got its own kind of kinetic energy to just go, listen, you got this. Just come on, right along with us.
Exactly. So moving on, let's talk Marvel Studios, the first 10 years, the definitive story behind the blockbuster studio. This was something, obviously, with our good friend and your co-writer, Paul Terry, put together, forward by Kevin Feige. You can't get much better than that. He's looking after the Star Wars universe now.
Well, yes, honestly, this is, I'm not, in actuality, this is our third year this week on the project. We got our offices at Disney 3 years ago this week, and this project is obviously taken a lot of different directions. I will say that is not the title anymore. It has broken out of the constraints of 10 years. I can't officially say what all of that is, but we just looked at what our approved cover is this week, and that'll be coming out relatively soon. The great thing about the project is that Paul Terry and I were embedded in Marvel Studios for these 3 years. We still, through all of quarantine, have been having meetings, if not every week. We were twice a week at the beginning of quarantine, and now we're waiting for layouts to catch up a little bit. But it is an epic book. It's two volumes. I will say in excess of 200,000 words. It's got everybody in it. And it's been an amazing process to actually really watch how they do what they do. We were on the set of Endgame. We were all over the place with getting to see what they do. And it is honestly the biggest thing that Paul Terry and I have ever done in our lives. It is quite the gauntlet in terms of two people almost never feels like it's enough to have gotten all of this material together, but it's also been a really amazing vantage point about, arguably one of the biggest, if not the biggest studio right now in terms of consistently making hits for the last 10 years plus. And so, it's going to be pretty epic, and there'll be more announcements about it. I'm not sure if it'll be announced this year, because obviously, like you said, with San Diego Comic-Con and kind of those opportunities to kind of announce things, maybe something in the fall, but I will say that yes, it is still coming out. It is bigger than it was before, and that obviously with COVID and printing issues and with retail issues, because obviously retail has been a real challenge for publishers right now, and going like, how do people see our books and what's the best time to put a book out? It's not going to come out this year, but it will come out in 2021.
You see, clearly the coronavirus was allowing for the fact that people can take a deep breath, pause, save their pennies, make sure they work on that basis. And then obviously it'll be all wonderful. You see, this is the positive side.
It will. And you know, the craziest thing, we were working to make this book while they're making, a slate that is only gotten more aggressive in the 3 years that we were with them. You know, it just TV shows now, and you know, more titles, and then this made everything stop. And I can say, as disappointing as it is for them to maybe not have a movie this year, you know, it all depends on what happens with theaters and Black Widow, and if it does come out this year, that would be in itself crazy. That since Iron Man came out, this would be the only year without a Marvel Studios release, obviously because of the situation, but it has been to the benefit of the book. You know, you'll have to find your silver lining, and it has allowed everyone's attention to the highest levels, all the way up to Kevin, to look at this book and provide new materials and have the opportunity to dig through their closets, because they were making movies and had no time to do that. Now they're like, well, I'm home, let me look for stuff. And so it really has been an absolute mother load of materials that, if this hadn't happened, you would not see some of the materials that are going to be in this book, just because it is literally one of the busiest studios in the world, and everybody's always all hands on deck. So I have to say that as sad as we are for whatever movies may or may not come out this year in 2021, you're going to have a book that's going to be pretty damn awesome, just in terms of what this has afforded everybody to kind of dig in, get their personal materials, and give it to us for this project.
There is, of course, that line in terms of it's often been mooted by film critics that in the new world in which we're living in, sometimes you ask yourself the question, is this worth, this is movie worth going to the theater for and potentially actually catching COVID for? And that's going to be a whole interesting element. I must admit, I'm very, very reluctant, even though the cinemas showcase has actually opened up its cinema chain in Britain. They're obviously aware of the whole thing. I'm just thinking, no, I don't think so. Not for a few months.
I'm with you, Alex. I love going to the movies. I love going to the movies in the summer. I love, you know, then the you know, kind of the more arty, award worthy movies, you know, for BAFTAs and for Oscars in the fall. But I don't think there's anything. Tenet, you know, Black Widow, as much as I'm excited to see that, I can't imagine myself wanting to go in a room where I went for a walk last week outside, made sure it was one of the very few times I've been out since March, made sure it was really breezy out, made sure it was sunny, everybody had masks on, and then I went by a guy who had no mask on, no shirt on, and was coughing every 5 feet. And I went, oh no, 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 no. I mean, it's enough to like put the genie back in the bottle. If I go into a theater and hear that, I'm going to feel like I'm going to want to bolt out of my chair. So I'm just not there yet either.
And it is that classic thing of, okay, fine. For your own point of view, you might think, okay, I can handle this. But it's a case of you could then be infected and then unwittingly infect somebody else without actually knowing it in the first place. It's a very, very tricky beastie that we've actually got here with respect to coronavirus.
So very true. And you know, your wonderful country has, you know, healthcare for all. And we don't. And I'm a freelancer, and I literally in the United States have to constantly think, if I get sick, I can't work, and how do I pay for my health insurance? So it is even another
Tara,
weird
you're always
thing
welcome
to think
in the
of.
United Kingdom, you know that. You know, you've got the role.
I may crawl in. I get one of those dispensations from your lovely country going like, oh, okay, she's okay. She can sit in she's a writer. She sits in a room. She's fine. She's basically, her whole life is a quarantine. So.
Exactly. And of course, there's Wonder Woman 84, which may or may not actually be released as well. That's the other biggie of the summer, together with Mulan, of course, the Disney live action aspect, which I think a lot of people are hedging a lot of bets on. It could well mean we're looking at a completely new film industry. We've talked about that. We're running a regular feature of new shows with film critic Richard Fitzwilliams and indeed BAFTA award-winning TV director Graham Harper about the future of cinema. And the bottom line is actually nobody really knows in terms of where we're going, how we're going to cope with that, because it is so different. And certainly because the quality of TV screenings has actually worked so much, and TVs in general have improved, maybe the home cinema experience is one of the ways forward. But that's for another debate, another talk.
Yes.
Tara, you always have kept busy, which is what we have appreciated about you, and all sorts of ways you've shared with us a whole variety of other bits and pieces as well. In terms of your role within SFX magazine, that still goes from strength to strength. We were doing a piece or so a week or so ago with the Flash Gordon edition, obviously. I can't believe it's 40 years since Flash
Isn't
Gordon.
Isn't that amazing? That's amazing. That was Rich's piece.
Absolutely.
And such a great piece. It's our cover piece for what's on stands right now. And yeah, one, talk about feeling old because I love that movie. and you go, ooh, that ages me.
The only thing I would say, Tara, is we don't use the O word. You're experientially enhanced or possibly chronologically gifted.
You know, I like that. That works for me. I will take that forever. Chronologically gifted is my new byline. Yeah. That's what I'm going to, I'm keeping that forever. For the magazine, we've been moving along. I can't thank them enough for, you know, still using me. Darren Scott's our new editor in chief, and it's been really great working with him. And I've done several pieces for this issue, and we're working on the fall because we're print, so we're always still looking ahead and moving forward. And you know, it is definitely a world, like you just said, where films and as a topic, a lot of that in magazine work and in writing work is going to more nostalgic and looking back at pieces that we love, because there aren't a lot coming out. But TV is still pretty robust. And so I have to say the fall is still shaping up with a lot of really good genre stuff. And we're excited to be covering it.
Including, of course, a brand new Batwoman, which is interesting news in terms of what's happening in the Greg Berlanti verse of Arrowverse, which seems to get bigger and bigger, really, with all sorts of DC connections on that basis. But
honestly, that is honestly, it feels almost in some ways a rival to the MCU. And I only say that because the DCU is still trying to figure itself out, you know, with this expansion and what directions it's going. But the Berlanti Arrowverse, basically, of the CW and the DC shows, it's huge. The tendrils of that are monstrous. And so if you were looking for interconnectivity with your storytelling, he's figured out how to do it and do it pretty well.
You got your Black Lightning, you got your Legends of Tomorrow, you got your Flash, you got your Supergirl. But then again, as I said, Supergirl surely will never be the same until, Tara, you can take over the mantle from Melissa Benoist. You know, these are
I'm in quarantine on my treadmill. I'm doing it. I'm almost there.
exactly so. And almost coming around to the two final questions, but now that Richard Edwards has basically said, yes, Darren is a good guy, I think you've also endorsed him. Do you think we should actually invite him to take part in one of these media matters and indeed midweek drive Zoomers, as we're referring to them?
Oh, yeah, he'd have, he would be a stitch. You would have a great time with him, and he loves his genre as well, so you would have a lot of fun things to talk to about him. I think he was even out here for Wonder Woman 84 watching a cut of it, sequences of it, so boy, if you want to talk Wonder Woman, I think that's your man to go to.
Well, there you go. Two final questions for you, Tara, as we begin to wrap up this sequence. Slight variation, obviously, because of the technology that we're employing. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Oh, it was a joy. It was a joy and a half.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future? Because as I say, a gap of something like a year and a half, it's far too long to be Tara Bennett-less.
Oh, I would love to come back. Whenever you want me, zoom in, zoom out, wherever you need. I'm here.